Welcome to Books, Stories, People with me, Nancy Richards.
Adventure athlete, speaker, author, husband and dad is how Jamie Murray defines himself. His book, Determination, an autobiography, is the inspirational story of the life-changing power of sport. In it, he shares his demons, his deeds, his giant endurance challenges, but first, his transformation, which took place when, I wondered.
I think definitely at the age of 19 was a huge defining moment for me, you know, where I realized that the path I was on in terms of drug abuse, substance abuse, was just getting me nowhere and was going to end up possibly even in my death, you know, and I just drew a line in the sand. I'm a very black or white person. There's no gray areas. And I drew the line and I said, I have to change my life now. And for me, you know, I always say to people that divine intervention comes in many different shapes and forms. And for me, it came through sport and this love for health and fitness that I've always had as a young kid. I always share the story of how I used to run everywhere as a child. And to this day, I'm on fast forward the whole time. So we ended up putting that to good use.
Well, you did end up putting it to good use, but I think your childhood, there were some mixed experiences, and I think you had some mixed role modeling, if you like. Tell me a little bit about your dad, who was a positive and can I say a negative role model at the
positive
same time?
And not so positive, yeah. So, I mean, I love my dad too, but we've got a great relationship. He was a positive role model in many ways because, just boundless energy. We call him to this day the eternal teenager. He's just never seems to grow old, at least in his mindset anyway. And then not such a great influence because, like many people of that era, you know, he wasn't great at showing affection. And there were a couple of moments that I talk about in the book as well where certain things were said that caused me to have a very, very bad self-esteem and probably didn't affect him very much when he said it, just nonchalantly. But for me, ended up in this need to prove myself for years. And it was only when I got to the age of 40 that I realized, man, you know what, I've been running around with this thing of having to prove myself to people for so long. And it was as a direct result of something that he'd said, a silly little thing he'd said, which we ended up discussing and having a laugh about. And he said, hey, my boy, no, I didn't mean it like that. But, you know, you carry that silly wound with you for so many years. But, I mean, I do love and honor my dad. He's a great guy.
But I think you say things sort of started to change at 19. But was it lack of self-esteem that got you into drugs in the first place? How did that happen?
No, I wouldn't say it was a lack of self-esteem at all. I think as a teenager, you face a lot of peer pressure. And I was an introvert at school, and I had a very small, tight group of friends. And, you know, when they all sort of started smoking weed, I just kind of naturally joined in. Although I was a very serious athlete at school in terms of cycling. But also, I had an older brother, a half-brother, who was a great guy but a bad influence as well, and he was heavily into drugs. And I mean, every, you know, 13-year-old just wants to be like his 19-year-old cool brother with the long hair and the weed hanging out of his mouth. So that was kind of, I think, also quite a big contributing factor to the negative space that I ended up in. But as I say, you know, when I was 19, I said, I can't carry on like this.
You know, you did a lot for a book like this. One has to do a huge amount of self-reflection to see, you know, what motivated you, what demotivated you, all the things that went wrong. And you described that you were very into sports. You were pretty good at a lot of sports, but you were also pretty accident prone. There were quite a lot of incidents in your life where you nearly didn't make it. Can you tell us about some of those?
Yeah, I do talk in great detail about many of those unfortunate moments in the book as well. But I don't know if accident prone is the right word. I think that when you do extreme sports and adrenaline sports, there's always going to be an element of danger and injury. But also, I mean, they talk about boys being partially brain damaged, you know, in the womb when the cortex forms and this testosterone actually flows over the brain, and that's what causes the dorsal fissure. And that actually results in a degree of literal brain damage on a very small scale. But they say that's often why a guy will go and do some absolutely silly thing like, you know, climb up a cliff like I did and get stuck up there and, you know, end up having to jump down, whereas a woman may not even put herself in that position in the first place because they don't have that cerebral damage like the men do as a result of testosterone. So I think a lot of the situations that I put myself in were just self-imposed childish stupidity, and some of them were situations that were totally beyond my control, like the moment or the incident rather when I ended up almost drowning out at sea, you know, going out on my stand-up paddleboard, not as a teenager, actually as a 30-something-year-old man, into huge wild oceans and trying to do what's called a downwind, you know, having to dodge oil tankers along the way and survive freezing water with almost full-blown hypothermia for nearly an hour. So again, I think that there's risk associated with everything that we do in life, even crossing the road, you know, and provided you understand the risk involved, you can plan for it, prepare for it, and eliminate that risk. And in many instances, in my case, particularly in my extreme expeditions, you don't know what to expect because no one's ever done it before. So it's very hard to plan for the unknown.
So you keep putting yourself out there nonetheless. But before we move on to the crazy things that you're doing now, let's just stay in your childhood, because there was one incident that you describe where you got stuck in a rock hyrax cave. And I think that that seems to have made a pretty big impact on you. What happened?
Yeah, that was a terrible experience, probably one of the worst experiences I've ever had. So it was grade 7 or grade 6 school camp, and we all went up to quite a wild place in here in South Africa called Louis Trichardt. And part of this sort of 10-day orientation and life skills development camp was they took us all up on a hike up a mountain, and they thought it would be fun to put us in an uncomfortable situation, which in this particular case was having to crawl on all fours into a very tight tunnel, which probably went about 20 meters into the side of this mountain, which had been carved out by these dussies, as we call them, the rock hyraxes. And I'd never suffered with claustrophobia, and sort of halfway through this tunnel, you know, the kid in front of me starts having a full-blown panic attack, which developed into claustrophobia, and he was trying to reverse out of this tunnel while I was trying to go forward. It was pitch dark, and eventually what happened was there were about 20 or 30 of us that got stuck in this blimming tunnel. And I'll never forget having to fight feelings of suffocation and claustrophobia in that moment. And that actually caused issues later on in life when I had to fly in aircraft and in helicopters for a job that I had at one point. And but thankfully there is a way to cure claustrophobia, and I go into quite a bit of detail in the book about that as well.
I just want to come back to the transformation and the pivotal moment, because there was over this wild kid who was on drugs doing all sorts of crazy things. What or who was it that made you turn a corner?
It was very much a spiritual experience that I had on an LSD trip, you know. And essentially what happened was I was about 3 or 4 hours into this LSD trip. And, you know, anyone listening who's ever experimented with drugs, specifically LSD, will know that once you've taken this particular drug, there's no way out. You know, you're going down the rabbit hole and there's no coming out until the effects of the drug wear off sort of 12 hours later. And I was about 3 or 4 hours into this experience, and I will never forget feeling so out of control. And not for the first time, I'd continually put myself in that position, because in my mind I felt that I would find the answers that I was looking for spiritually by going into that altered state of consciousness. And I didn't. All I found was confusion and fear. And at one point in time, I remember actually just sort of praying and asking for divine assistance and help, and basically asking God to help me. And I'll never forget this feeling of, it was almost like a waterfall that opened over me. And to this day, I'll never forget how the effects of that drug after 3 or 4 hours were 100% reversed. I was completely back to normal. And that's why to this day, you know, my faith plays a big role in all of the expeditions I do. There's always an element of prayer and devotion involved, and an understanding and a belief from myself that a lot of the strength I have and that I've been given as an athlete is divine, for the purpose of helping and inspiring people to believe in themselves and overcome the challenges that they themselves face in life.
Well, you were lucky to come out of that whole trip alive and well. And you moved then on into sort of, can I call it the corporate world? You became a sort of a businessman. Just tell us about that transition, having come out of that really bad space. Mm. What the transition, how was that?
You know, I've always been a hard-working man ever since a kid. I've always loved hard work, so not one to shy away from picking up the plow and the shovel, so to speak. So, you know, hard work will always help you progress quickly in life. And the corporate world came sort of in my mid-20s. We just got married and I entered the world of, you know, selling printers and business-to-business solutions. And I did very, very well, you know. And a couple of years later, I was in my 30s and a very good friend of mine's father-in-law was the chairman of a listed property development group here in South Africa. And he thought it would be a good idea to get me in front of this guy with a view to presenting a sponsorship proposal for a cycling team. And it was going to be a little two-man team. And, you know, I went into the meeting and pulled off a massive multi-million rand deal for six riders. I mean, we brought in some of the top riders. We had our own branded Mercedes Vito van. And we did so well that the chairman called me back and one of his directors and said, listen, if you could get us to spend and invest that much on a cycling team, you should actually be selling and marketing for us. And that, I would say, is where my true sort of corporate roots were established. And I developed a very, very acute understanding and a deep insight into the world of strategic marketing, brand positioning, relationship development, and working with high net investors. And, you know, sadly, a couple of years later, life would throw possibly one of the biggest commercial curveballs that's ever been thrown, which was, you know, serving on the board of directors of an incredible, also a luxury property development group, and then hearing the news that my dear friend, the chairman, Chris, had died in a tragic accident. And this guy was not just a colleague and an associate. He was a mentor. He was a father figure. He was a friend. And our family were very close to him. And at that point in time, they had actually just proposed an equity share deal for myself in this big development project, which was a massive success, according to the chairman, as a result largely of my efforts. And unfortunately, when he died, there was no honoring of this verbal agreement, which we were in the process of formalizing in terms of putting pen to paper. And essentially, the entire board of directors and all the senior staff were made redundant, which was hard to accept. But that was in 2010. And if you cast your mind back, 2010, we were still in global economic recession. So that resulted in a very, very hard sort of 5, 6, 7 year period for me. And things only started coming right in 2017 after my world record on Table Mountain, where the chairman of the group that I work for now saw me on TV and asked me to come up and head up their corporate business unit.
Sure, there have been a lot of changes, eh? But you, just whilst we talk about cycling and business, I just have to ask a question about Lance Armstrong, because you managed to persuade Lance Armstrong to come and be part of one of the gigs that you were doing. So how was that experience, given Lance Armstrong's rather checkered background?
Yeah, well, obviously a lot more disappointing once he went on the Oprah show and made the announcement, which came not as a surprise. I mean, we all suspected, you know, that he wasn't racing clean. But, you know, just one correction. I wasn't responsible directly for bringing him to South Africa, but I was part of the official management team, yeah, and the official organizing committee of this Lance for Life tour in 2010, which was a great highlight and a huge honor to be involved in. But what I want to say about Lance Armstrong is, despite his deviations and despite his use of performance enhancing drugs, I still respect him as an athlete to this day, because they were all doping at that time. And you don't inject EPO into your left leg and then into your right leg, go to bed, wake up and be the best cyclist in the world. You know, the amount of training that has to go in regardless of that. So I'm not condoning for a minute what he did and his use of performance enhancing drugs. But what I am saying is, I still think that he was a phenomenal athlete who, despite using drugs, worked harder than anybody else and channeled and harnessed his own inner demons to help him win those seven Tour de France's. So hats off to him for that, although not quite done in the right way.
I guess there are lessons to be learned from everybody, and certainly somebody else from whom you would have learned a lesson or two was Richard Branson, who you had rather a strange encounter with. What did you learn from him?
I think it's what he learned from me. I don't know how I say this on the podcast, but I'll just say it straight up like I do in the book. So I did have the privilege of spending a few days as one of his chaperones when he was in Cape Town for a while. He was out here for a sort of 3-day event prior to the Argus Cycle Tour, and I was involved in arranging the vehicle sponsorship for Mercedes-Benz, who were the official vehicle partner to this Ride with Richard Branson event. And I agreed to, you know, get the sponsorship in place on the condition that I could be his driver, and went to the airport, picked him up, and we're driving along to Arabella Golf Estate, who a lot of our listeners would probably know here in the Western Cape, close to Hermanus. And, you know, Sir Richard Branson leans over to me and says, "So, Jamie, I believe you've done a fair amount of cycling in your days. You know, have you got any tips for a first timer for the Argus Cycle Tour?" And I looked at him and I said, "Well, Richard, how much cycling have you done? I mean, are you fit? Have you been riding?" And he says, "Well, you know, the last time I was on a bicycle was probably when I was about 8 years old." So I looked at him and I said, "Well, Richard, in that case, I've really only got one thing to say to you in terms of my advice to you for the Argus Tour." And he said, "Yes, what's that?" And I said, "Bum cream." He said, "Sorry, what's that?" I said, "Bum cream." I said, "You know what?" I said, "Your butt is going to take a beating. You're going to be on that bike for 6 or 7 hours, maybe 5 or 6 if you're lucky. And my advice is go to the pharmacy and get a big tub of bum cream and make sure you are well smeared." And he was broken. He hosed himself. He was laughing his head off, like the laugh he'd been needing the whole day. And I remember him saying, "Oh, Jamie, so does one sort of just go to the local pharmacy and say, 'Could I have a tub of bum cream, please?'" And this banter went back and forth for what felt like an hour. So that was an interesting experience. And I did find him to be a lovely, lovely gentleman, very polite and respectful, and just an incredible man to have met.
We need to get on to your giants, your four giants, your big, big challenges. And I guess you would recommend something a whole lot more than bum cream for doing all the things that you've been doing. So let's go straight to the challenges. What are they, and where did this idea come from? I mean, it's obviously been building up for a long time, but what got you to the challenge point, and what are those challenges?
It's such a great question. You know, it was actually part of turning down an all-expenses-paid immigration opportunity to Canada. I won't bore you with the detail of that, but the short version is that my wife and I met an incredible gentleman, very successful Canadian businessman, and he was very keen on the idea of supporting a young South African entrepreneur with establishing himself in another country for various reasons, and largely geared around his perception that our economy was going nowhere slowly. And so we went across for a month, and I was actually looking at setting up a fast food chain in Canada. And ultimately, we turned the opportunity down for a number of reasons. There were a couple of things that weren't clicking together in terms of the commercial backing for the project. You know, it's easy to talk about funding a big project until it comes to putting pen to paper, and it definitely strained the relationship to a degree as well. But also, as beautiful as Canada was, it wasn't home for us. You know, we love South Africa. We're very patriotic. So we came back to South Africa with a renewed appreciation for the quality of life we have here. But also, as far as I was concerned, I had a renewed awareness of the challenges that people are facing in everyday life. And that's when I decided, well, as someone who was given the opportunity and who had the opportunity to leave this country and who's elected to stay, I will fall into one of two camps: the moaners and groaners who complain about how terrible this country is, or the positive thinkers who actually stand up, put their hand up, and offer to do something positive. And I was trying to think about what I could do in my way, my unique Jamie Murray way, to help inspire people to face the giants that they were facing in their personal lives. And that's when I started coming up with this idea of the four giants challenge, you know. And I thought, okay, but what would these four giants be? And I started thinking about various giants, you know. Well, Table Mountain's the biggest giant it's the southern, well, almost the southernmost tip of Africa. Second, obviously, we've got Cape Agulhas, but it's in the south of Africa. It represents a mountain, an obstacle, a challenge. And how about going for the record for the most summits ever attempted or documented in the history of Table Mountain? And the record was 14 at that stage. And then I thought, okay, well, what about, you know, Kilimanjaro? And what about? And I started thinking about metaphors that were big giants. The challenge, however, being you know, you need sponsors to go and take on all these challenges. And eventually the Four Giants Challenge evolved into this ongoing series of ultra endurance challenges that each take place in a beautiful, breathtaking, but also dangerous setting here in South Africa, mostly because it's more accessible for us in terms of not needing big sponsors to come on board to make an expedition possible. So sort of working with what you've got. So to answer your question, the project was birthed out of a sincere desire to help inspire people through sport. And I felt that the best platform to do that would be to set up a series of extreme endurance challenges, each of which represented a metaphor for what people are facing in everyday life. And I'm probably sitting on sort of 7 or 8 giants now that I've taken on. Most of them weren't even part of the original plan. Some I've done, some I haven't been able to do because of funding and sponsors. So you work with what you've got. But there's a lot of exciting and incredible projects that have come on board that were definitely not part of the initial plan, like when I recently became the first person to ride a mountain bike for 36 hours in a Big Five game reserve. And that will be the sequel to the current book, Determination. And that book will be called either Taming the Beast or Riding for Rhinos, I'll see.
Well, certainly in this book, Determination, you've undertaken Table Mountain big time. In fact, we're sitting halfway up Table Mountain. It's lovely. And I think your plan was to run up and down Table Mountain 24 times in 24 hours, which in anybody's book is virtually impossible and complete madness, I would want to say. But you weren't able to do it. It had to be broken down a little bit. Tell us about the breakdown and tell us about the process.
Yeah, it was a very, very heartbreaking and frustrating and soul-destroying process because I was convinced that 24 summits in 24 hours was humanly possible, and I now know that I was good for it. But I was unfortunately forced to split the actual challenge over 2 days, not because I wanted to, but because Sand Parks, who are the custodians who govern the use and what can and can't be done on Table Mountain, required it in order to give me permission to hold what they deemed as an event. Although there was only one athlete, i.e. myself, I had a large support crew of about 24 people around the mountain and a base camp at the top, a base camp at the bottom, and they said, well, this is an event. And for us to sanction and approve and rubber stamp an event, you are not allowed to run through the night. They said, we'll give you an hour before sunrise and an hour after sunset over 2 days. So you need to now repackage your attempt as the greatest number of summits in 48 hours over 2 days. And initially I kicked against it and I wanted to go public. And eventually I said, you know what, I'm actually just going to work with them. And they welcomed it. They said, if you work with us, we will actually endorse your project. So it was a little bit like allowing yourself to lose the battle to ultimately win the war. And I did end up still making a whopping 22 summits in 28 hours over 2 days, 28 hours of moving time, so 2 14-hour slots. And I don't believe that that record will be broken soon. I mean, I know what I went through for those 2 days. It was unbelievably difficult. The second day was even more difficult than the first because your body's completely broken. I did 12 summits on the first day. Bearing in mind, the record for 12 hours is 14 summits. So that in itself was very close to the record in 12 hours, and then moved on to the next 10 summits. So, you know what? I think sometimes you have to lose the battle to win the war, and that's okay. And it's generally just the ego that gets a bit bruised in the process.
Well, it's working with what you've got, as you said. I think all of us who live in Cape Town have got a huge respect for the mountain, and I long to know which route you took up the mountain. Did you go up Platteklip Gorge, and how was it? I mean, were come sort of the sixth summit, were you not thinking, this is for the birds? You know, how were you mentally and physically?
Yeah, so I used the traditional route, the Platteklip Gorge, up, ran across the top, jumped in the cable car, ran down. That was the only way to get through that number of summits, and that was also the format of the previous record for 12 hours. And yeah, what was I thinking after 6 hours? Man, I got to my sixth summit, exactly my sixth summit, and I was started limping across the top of the mountain because I'd actually decided to embark on this challenge with what's called a labral tear in my right hip socket. So it was basically an overuse injury. I wasn't aware of it until a week before the actual event. I ended up, and you'll see in the book, there's a photograph of me lying about to have an MRI scan. And, you know, I was diagnosed with this torn hip socket, essentially, and I still chose to continue because thankfully I wasn't running down, so I was able to handle the climbing a little bit better. But you know, Nancy, the worst summit for me was summit number 14, 15, and 16, or summits number 14, 15, and 16. They were absolutely terrible, dark. What was I going through? I felt like I was going through hell. I mean, it was just, I was so broken that I wasn't even able to put one foot in front of the next for the best part of it. I mean, I was actually, yeah, man, I was broken, to put it bluntly, you know. And I got to number 16, and at that point my mantra was just keep putting one foot in front of the next, you know. It's the little steps that get you to the top. And then at summit number 17, it was quite amazing because the previous record holder came running out the bush on a training run, and he saw me about to start my 17th summit, but unbeknown to him, I was actually going for it for this big record. And he said to me, "Jamie, are you going for your thing today?" I said, "Yeah." And he said, "Well, how many have you done?" I said, "I'm starting number 17. And he said, "Wow." You know, and then he said, "Okay, let me pace you up." So he paced me up my 17th summit, and that was actually the fastest out of all 22 summits. So it's quite amazing. You know, I always say the body follows where the mind leads. And from 17, 18, 19, 20, all the way through to 22, I felt strong, I felt powerful, I felt able to just carry on indefinitely.
But you know, even the mind takes a pounding, and there must be a point where the mind says, no, this is not okay, this is just crazy. And I'm thinking about your Sani Pass cycle ride, which, if you were broken doing the Table Mountain, this, just reading about that made me feel totally exhausted. And it wasn't just against yourself that you were pushing, it was against all the climatic conditions, again, everything was against you. What keeps you going in something like that, where one can only think, you know, you're crazy? I mean, your teammates were on your side, but what kept you going? It must have been, it was madness.
Well, you know, what always keeps me going on all of these extreme challenges is the knowledge that what I'm doing is making a difference to somebody's life, you know, and the temporary suffering that I'm enduring and allowing myself to go through, it's actually totally self-imposed, is something that somebody who's going through a really, really tough time can actually relate to metaphorically. And it's knowing that my visible suffering is going to help somebody else deal with and push through what they're going through, whether it's physical, mental, emotional, financial, commercial. I always say, you know, all of us are facing giants, but no giant is ever too big to face. And that is what keeps me going in those dark moments.
Your line, I think, is you have to go further. You have to reach the end of yourself. Just explain what you mean there.
Yeah, so I do believe that superhuman strength is something that anybody can access. But first, you have to go through the long, dark tunnel of fatigue and exhaustion. And it's only once you've pushed through that long, dark tunnel that, you know, you break through into this realm of finding strength you never even knew you had. But most people don't really want to put themselves in that situation of hyper fatigue and extreme fatigue. And again, I'm not recommending this. You know, people may have health issues. I'm not saying go and run until you know, almost dying and then push through. I'm not saying that. But what I'm saying is that, you know, endurance is not just a physical thing. It's a mental thing as well, not giving up. And I do believe that because the body follows where the mind leads, I believe that quitting and failure takes place in your mind before it takes place in the physical realm and your outside body. You quit mentally first, and then the body follows. The body follows where the mind leads. So for me, it's about staying focused. And you know what, Nancy? Quitting, for me, is never an option. Somebody asked me the other day, you know, don't you think about quitting the whole time, and how do you overcome the urge to quit? I said, before I start a particular challenge, I bend over, you know, as if I'm gasping for air, and I sort of stretch down towards the ground, and I breathe deeply, and I actually disengage the option of quitting. So I make peace with what I'm about to endure and suffer and go through for the next 12, 24, or 36 hours. I accept it, I embrace it, and I make peace mentally with the fact that quitting is not an option, and that definitely allows me to endure beyond, as the press always say, what's perceived as humanly possible.
Whilst quitting might not be an option for you, you do, as you've said, have a wife and three children. Are you not concerned? Are they not concerned? I'm sure your wife has concerns about seeing you do things that are basically death-defying. Yeah. Well, how do the two of you deal with that?
Yeah, you know, I mean, there's obviously a lot of communication. Sometimes there's no communication. The less she knows, the better, you know. There's always very unpleasant conversations I have to have with my core support crew before we hit the start button. The night before, I'll talk about if something goes wrong, who speaks to the press, who speaks to my wife. I mean, you have to put those plans in place because there is an element of extreme danger to myself, my health, my life in all of these things. I mean, the ride in the game reserve, there were elephants in the area, there were buffalo. I mean, you know, you're descending a hill at night, you know, you've been riding for 24 hours, you're fatigued, and suddenly a herd of buffalo come walking up the mountain. I mean, you know, you're gonna be trampled to death. There was a big elephant that actually hassled me a lot. He was moving around in the area for the full 36 hours, and he actually stopped me dead in my tracks at one point. He stopped the whole project, you know, for about 10 minutes. So, you know, I think after so many years of doing these projects, you know, my wife understands that whilst I am a risk taker, I will do everything possible to eliminate as much risk as I can. And that's the assurance. And then I also, her assurance and my family's assurance is I always have one person on my team who I give carte blanche to make an executive decision about my safety at any point in time, because I disengage, I switch off, and the switch goes, and I just go for it. I won't stop no matter what happens. And I always have one person who's my expedition leader. His name's Rob, and I give him the right to stop me at any stage. And he's done that on one occasion where it was just too dangerous to continue, and I almost got blown off a mountain.
Certainly inspirational it is, and hell of a good stories that you have as a result of this, and here you are, but mercifully here to tell the tale. But aside from inspiring people, who are the beneficiaries? I mean, this is a lot to put yourself through for your own benefit, well, which is hardly beneficial, but for your own purposes and for inspiring other people. Do you have beneficiaries?
Definitely so, yeah. So I only work with foundations, people, and causes that are close to my heart and in genuine need of help and support. I made the decision early on as an adventure athlete not to take the wide road of trying to align my projects with big foundations to try and make my projects look big. I'm very open to people approaching me and saying, hey, Jamie, we've got a great need in this area. We work with, malnourished kids. We work with whatever it might be. So some of the beneficiaries over the years have been the Sabrina Foundation in Plettenberg Bay on the East Coast in South Africa. Incredible family, incredible story. They lost their little girl, Sabrina, at the age of 8 and set up a foundation in her memory, which raises money for special needs kids. So the Table Mountain record attempt was for that. And then I've moved on to other projects that I've supported as well. One being the Head Start Kids Foundation, which was working for or raising money for early childhood development. Kids that just aren't getting the right levels of nourishment, which affects their ability to learn and retain knowledge. And then more recently, the Kericha Foundation and the anti-poaching unit. So the Kericha Foundation, just to go back one step, Kericha is one of our most beautiful privately owned Big Five game reserves in South Africa. They don't enjoy government support because they're privately owned, but you know they do obviously fund initiatives like the anti-poaching unit, who are the guardians of the rhinos at Kericha, who unfortunately have been targeted in terms of poaching over the years. And then the Kericha Foundation also support a large number of soup kitchens in the area. So my idea with that one was to support community and conservation, so help the anti-poaching unit as well as the communities of those affected by COVID in the area. But Nancy, you know, I can't go and take on an ultra endurance challenge just to try and prove a point or make a point. I find that when my ego gets involved, it fails. It doesn't even get off the ground. And that takes me back to your why, you know, your why is so important. My why is so important. You have to sit down and be honest with yourself and ask yourself that question and say, why do I do what I do? And why do I want to do what I want to do? So I think one of the most important questions you can ever ask yourself is, why do I do what I do? And why do I want to do what I want to do? And if your answer is, I want to prove a point, I want to make a point, well, then good luck to you. It's probably not going to happen. But if it's something bigger than your ego, chances are you'll succeed.
Yeah, you mentioned children there, and I'm thinking about your own children. You know, we started off talking about how your dad had impacted your life for better or for worse, etc. Mm-hmm. And I wonder, how are you impacting your children's mm-hmm. life? And are you doing that very consciously? And the sort of lessons you're learning, what do you encourage them to do?
So we've got a very interesting little quiver of children. You know, we've got a daughter who is an absolute artist. She wants to study design and fashion. She's not very inclined towards sport, ironically, with a dad like me, but she could be a world-class athlete if she wanted to. She's got incredible natural genetics, but not interested in sport. Then my middle son, Liam, after 2 years of playing golf, he's playing off a 2 handicap. He's earned himself a scholarship in a private school as a result of his golf. He's very driven, very focused. Whatever he picks up, he excels at. He's not that academically inclined, but he's just a born sportsman. So he could be a professional athlete in whatever career he chooses. And he's chosen golf, which I think is very prudent. And then old man Sam, as we call him, who's an old man in a 10-year-old's body. He is the wisest little owl you've ever met in your life. Just the most awesome little dude. But he's very opposed to risk. He's the kind of guy, I'll take mountain biking and he'll say, hey, Dad, why does that sign say mineshaft? It must be quite dangerous, you know? So with him, I'm always having to slow down the intensity, reduce the amount of adrenaline involved, which is ironic, again, with a dad like me. So to answer your question, what am I teaching them? I think what I'm teaching them and what they're learning through observation is just to think big, to take on big projects, not to hold back, not to let fear control your actions and your destiny. And I think they're realizing that anything is possible. And more than that, I think they're realizing that they can do anything if they put their minds to it, because they've seen their dad set world records and push himself to the point of absolute exhaustion and beyond. They've seen it all. They were with me in the game reserve watching me for 36 hours, supporting me through the night. So they've seen me turning myself inside out, and it's hard to say what they learn in that moment. You know, I think seeing your dad push himself to the point of sort of near death in certain cases, in terms of just exposure to danger and that, for worthy causes, that's got to impact you as a kid growing up. So I can't say for sure what they take out of it, but I would think logically just having a mindset that nothing's impossible is one of the things that they'll take.
One can only but imagine what their mum takes out of it and how fear might impact her life, but that's another story. Perhaps that's another book from her. Just lastly, you've got very many giants under your belt, so to speak. What's your next one, and what's the next step?
Yeah, that's actually the question I've been asked the most subsequent to publishing the book. I have a few ideas. I don't want to create too much of an expectation at this point. I do have a project that I've been planning for a while now called Riding to the Moon, and essentially it's not literally riding to the moon, although I would like to be the first person to ride a bicycle on the moon. Maybe I should chat to Sir Richard about that. But I actually don't think it's that far off, to be honest. I think it's something I'll be able to do in my lifetime. But getting back to your question, the next project is probably going to be a collection of challenges which have been on the back burner for a while. So I'd really like to get the 700k paddle across the longest lake in the world in Africa, Lake Tanganyika. I'd like to get that done. It is full of 20-foot crocs, so very dangerous and hostile place. There's a lot of rebels and war in certain areas up there, so it's not the best place to go for a paddle, but I would like to get that done. I would like to get the Kilimanjaro Speed Summit done. both been very, very expensive expeditions. So again, if somebody steps forward and says, hey, we'd like to fund these projects, great, but times are tough for people, and self-funding expeditions like this is costly. And then I'd like to finish up with, you know, there's a big mountain pass in India. It's the highest motorable road in the world, and I'd love to go and do a 24-hour stint up there and see how much ascent I can accumulate. And if possible, ride up to just over 7,000 meters, which will be the highest altitude ever ridden at on a bicycle. So very much in the early stages, but I think it'll make for great viewing and TV. And then, you know, there's a herd of elephants in Manipur's, the last of the great tusk elephants. They call them the great tuskers. And I have been approached to assist, you know, the conservation authorities in the area with doing a similar project with my mountain bike involved and riding amongst the elephants to try and create awareness and raise support for them. So looking forward to that. Can't give you any specific dates, but what I can say at the moment is, you know, I'm very proud to have finally finished my first book, Determination, and I'm already at work on the second book, which is probably going to be called Riding for Rhinos, and that'll tell the story of you know, just the beauty that's come out of COVID in terms of this Jamie Rides for Rhinos project and how many thousands of people's lives around the world have been positively impacted by that.
Well, the only thing I've got to say is very best of luck with all of the above. But very, very lastly, how much of a giant was it for you writing a book? You're kind of a physical sort of a person. So sitting down and writing a book, how much of a challenge was that?
It was a huge challenge because, you know, I mean, you've probably gathered for yourself, you know, that I'm a 24/7 person, but what a lot of people don't know is I shut down at 9 o'clock at night every single night, like clockwork. I have for years, and I find it very difficult to work academically at night or creatively at night. So for me, I was writing at sort of 3:30 in the morning before work. I'm a working dad. I have a normal working class dad. I have a standard day job as well, and I'm a family man and trying to make time for everyone, training, projects, planning, expeditions, work, kids, my wife. So it was very challenging writing a book. And yeah, as I said, a lot of the book was written, probably 80% of it was written in the early hours before even the birds were awake, you know, sort of putting in 2 or 3 hours. And by 6 or 7 o'clock, I'd done a couple of hours. And if you just keep chiseling away, eventually, you know, you'll get there. But I did make a concerted effort during lockdown last year to finish the book, which I finally did.
Well, then, in that case, very best of luck with the next book. Thank you.
Oh, thanks, Nancy. It was great chatting to you and lovely to be up here on the slopes of Table Mountain. So all the best. And to everyone listening, I just want to say, grab a copy of the book. And once you're done, please share it with someone who's going through a tough time. The book's available as an ebook as well on Amazon. And just remember that nothing you're facing is ever too big to face and overcome.